It's Saturday, June 8th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the air with me is Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a web instructor and world traveler. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
And Bonnie Jean Primsch. And Bonnie Jean Primsch, of course, is a mediator, a broadcaster at large, and a printmaker.
Sure she is, of course.
Yes, of course she is. Welcome.
Thanks.
It's funny.
Of course.
Imagine if you came up to people during the day and go, instead of saying hello, you said, Ben Jaffe, you're a world traveler, programmer. Thank you. I am.
Hi.
Only slightly awkward.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good. It's interesting when the way you phrase things without visual cues. So that's why we do that on radio. Man, I listen to a lot of podcasts. There's a lot of people out there that have some wonderful knowledge, but don't have a lot of experience with radio. And I'm constantly going, oh, please just repeat the name of the product you mentioned 10 minutes ago. Because it's fascinating. I'm totally interested. And they just don't close
Moving
up.
Moving on now.
Moving on. Let's go on. Ben, news stories. Sir, hi.
Hi there. So I have an interesting news story about the United Kingdom government and their public sector IT, the United Kingdom.
Are you making this
UK?
Up?
No, I'm not. But so here's a quote for you. Quote. I came into the office and I pressed my PC, and it took me 7 minutes to boot up, he told attendees. That's government in the old world. That's 3 days of the year I waste of my time booting up. That's 3 days of the work year that is wasted.
Oh, I see. He's calculated out the boot time. Yeah.
Booting.
I follow. Okay.
So, let me
translate that for everybody.
Translate it, yeah.
Okay. So, computer takes a certain amount of time to start, and this person has come in, recorded how much time it takes to start, and then calculated out times 2,000 because that's how many times a day he works, or she works, whatever, and that came up to 3 days. That's so really slow.
How long does your computer take to boot, do you think?
Well, I don't boot my computer. I put it to sleep. It's on. I'm actually frustrated because when I open my screen, it takes maybe 20 seconds before the keyboard's working. I open my screen and start typing. It doesn't work. I'm like, I have to wait for 20 seconds. It's so frustrating.
I kind of want you to run.
I kind of want you to open up the terminal and run uptime just to see how many days you've been up.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, like, it takes probably 40 seconds for me to boot my computer.
14 days.
You've been up 14 days.
Well, my computer has been awake for 14 days. I rebooted recently, I guess. I actually have an update pending. By the way, if you're on an OS X environment, that's a Macintosh environment, or a Linux environment, there's a command in the command line called uptime. It's just one word. And what's your uptime?
11 days, 21 hours, 41 minutes. So you win, and I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, you got a Windows machine. You can't do that.
I'm very patient. That's what I know.
You know what I hate, though? is when I shut down my computer, it's always right after I press shut down that I remember, oh, I should have looked.
Ah, yes.
And there's no way. I can look at logs and things, but I don't.
You need
too
to set
lazy.
Up a daemon process that will record uptime to your to somewhere for you.
Anyway, so
we geeked out there for a minute, Bonnie. Sorry about that.
What do you do with that information once you know how much time you've wasted? What do you do? Just yourself? What do you do with that information?
How does this employee actually benefit from this knowledge that takes 3 minutes or 3 days?
Here's another statistic for you: the UK government.
And that's the first question.
What is this, politics?
Spends £6,000 per year per desktop on maintenance and all of that.
Okay, so you take the IT infrastructure of the government and you count the amount of machines and you divide it out.
£6,000 is a lot of money.
This is a complaint about time and money being spent.
Yeah. So, I mean, £6,000
is also the difficulty in administering computers. I mean, we all think that it's, it's simple. The truth of the matter is,
there's a reason your IT guy's crabby.
All IT people are crabby.
But I mean, if we're talking about this many computers, you get something from economies of scale, right? I mean, yes, IT is
very
difficult.
Have you worked in government?
Yes, IT is very difficult, but I mean, £6,000 per year is a lot of money.
That's real money. That's not even like, US dollars. That's real money.
Yeah, I mean, the article says that's 10 iPads, right? So 10 iPads per year. That's like an iPad a month in IT costs. If you want to think of it that way.
That's only an iPad for 12 employees.
Over the years, Ben, that's like you've had the greatest metrics of like, let me explain this for you. This is how many burritos this is worth.
Yeah,
like,
actually,
we're talking about buying cars. What?
This is serious lunch.
I have to say, I was just about to convert it into burritos for you guys.
That's not helpful to me at all.
A burrito every 3 days for someone to maintain your computer. So,
well, they might cost more in England.
And
burritos.
These are computers.
I think they're a rare commodity.
If I could buy someone lunch every 3 days to have all my computer woes taken care of, I would do it in a heartbeat.
Well, but that's not to have all your computer woes taken care of. Have you worked in government?
No.
I mean, like, really? So, I mean, I don't know. It's just kind of surprising how high the numbers are.
It is pretty interesting.
That's the story here. Basically, big companies and governments, it's fun. It's amazing how these numbers get bigger and bigger and bigger. And suddenly, you're maintaining, you know, maybe 10 or 100,000 computers, but your costs are still ridiculously high. And they don't have to be that high. I mean, there are plenty of ways to mitigate these issues. I mean, if you were to take these 6,000 pounds per year per desktop and buy everyone a brand new top-of-the-line laptop, I mean, still would have issues in IT and managing all of these devices. But I mean, 7 minutes to boot up. That's a lot of money there, too.
There are some wasted time there. The boot up cycle, because of the old computers, makes that is an issue. But I have to say that knowing the way complex companies and corporations work with their infrastructure, very commonly, like the reason why we have old operating systems running is because we have applications that people use that require that, right? There are some backwards compatibility problems that kind of emerge in large scale like that. What if there's a copy of, you know, Lotus Notes somewhere? They've got to run.
What's Lotus Notes?
Exactly. Moving on. Thanks, Ben.
So,
I mean, since we're talking about government, the big news this week in tech has been this scandal. Bonnie, you want to give us the lowdown on it?
We should have background music to this.
Yeah,
like,
it's kind of
foreboding background music.
Well, first there was a Verizon thing, right, which is apparently separate, kind of, or related to this PRISM program, the NSA. I'm not sure what PRISM stands for. But the original claim was, oh my God, you guys, all these companies are totally looking at everything you do. And apparently, over the course of the week, that has become more and more measured. Apparently, all these companies are involved, but they're not just sort of, you know, opening up all their information to the NSA.
Yeah.
They accept requests from the NSA and then consider fulfilling them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I've been following this news story the last couple of days, and it's becoming, you know, more and more clear. What happened yesterday was that Google and Facebook responded very publicly by their CEOs saying, we do not do this. The claim in the original report was very clearly that the government has direct access to major Silicon Valley corporations.
Yeah, direct
Google,
access.
Apple, Yahoo, Facebook, and so on.
And there's sort of like a charmingly amateurish PowerPoint slideshow. I mean, four of the slides were made public where they're like, look at all these companies who over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years have signed on and just rolled over and just, you know,
given us everything,
opened
yeah.
themselves up to
and,
us.
And now, as the response from the corporations has been, no, what are you talking about? You're crazy. Because that's what, like, Larry...
Zuckerberg,
they've been saying, we do not do that. That's not true. And so then the question in the kind of the blogosphere rapid response was, wait a second, are they lying to us? Most likely not. These people are pretty clear that they want to be transparent. If they were lying, it seems like it'd be out of character for them, especially so publicly. And then secondly, is it possible the corporation's doing something without the CEO knowing? That's kind of an interesting concept, right? That it's possible that somewhere in the structure of Google, it's a giant company, right? That someone has signed and dealt with NSA and has a pipeline that the CEO doesn't know about. And maybe the company itself is protecting the CEOs from knowledge of this, right?
It's possible.
I think it's unlikely. It feels a little tinfoil hat to me.
I'm thinking it might be more linguistic. Like, well, we don't give them direct access.
Right. So
we might do something.
The report this morning that I read after, so that kind of puts this all at ease a little bit, this PRISM... this PowerPoint presentation, which only 4 of the 41 slides have actually been released. So we don't actually know the real content.
Yeah.
And only the Washington Post and the Guardian and, of course, whoever wrote the slideshow, who probably is not happy right now, knows the whole details. But it's clear that the detail of what companies were actually in cahoots, it's not that slide did not say that Facebook was pushing over data. Mm-hmm. But this does come to a topic that GeekSpeak talks about all the time. We cover this quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And that is that... You know, Facebook makes money by tracking us and keeping track and selling ads to us. We cover this regularly. And Google, of course, is giving us services for advertising revenue. And to do that best and effectively, they need to keep track of us and search us and look through our email and all this stuff, right? So we know that we're trading our privacy all the time for these services. And we, on GeekSpeak, try to be clear about what that means so that all of us are kind of aware of it. I think that's the most important thing. You know, you're aware. Yeah. Like, you should be aware that when you see a commercial for Coke and everything, that there's sexiness in it and it's manipulating you. You know, that awareness of what's happening to you is important. Yeah. So, but what's interesting is that we've also been saying the whole time, well, if you allow for backdoors or if you don't have the protocols in place, it's easier to detect what's happening. And if we cover these kind of details that are more technically nuanced than I could put on a couple PowerPoint slides to talk about, yes, the government almost definitely does have a lot of data about Google users and what they're doing and Facebook users and what they're doing. And they can glean that information from pretty easy sources, especially if they have cahoots with the telcos, which they do. That's the part that's kind of creepy. Even if Google and Facebook's doing as much as they can, and they've improved that feature set over the years. So now, right now, when you do Google searches and when you do Facebook interaction, you're using a protocol called TLS or HTTPS. And in that format, your traffic can't be sniffed by your ISP, right? So if I use my machine right now and I go through a Wi-Fi access point here in the building, we're not using encryption protocol for that, so people can sniff on that line, but I'm using a protocol between me and Google or me and Facebook, which is completely tight, so no one can look at that traffic. But that has been forced only in the last year or so, that it's really been forced that way.
Right.
And then there are breaches and holes. Like, for example, you use Amazon's Kindle thing, right? So Amazon realized that them pushing through all this content over kind of expensive network lines for the Kindle was actually not as efficient for them for network traffic. So they made a decision to not extend that pipeline of security from Ben's Kindle all the way to Google. Instead, Ben gets a compiled version that's better for his device from Amazon, which means Amazon can look at that traffic. So that's one of those holes that, from a technical perspective, if you trust Amazon, it's okay. It's not so. It is.
That's the Kindle tablet, not the Kindle devices.
That's right.
The normal readers.
But it's one of these nuances. Like, to describe the detail of that is, you know, a 20-minute discussion on GeekSpeak.
Yeah, that's not a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, not a PowerPoint slide. So can Amazon find out what Ben is reading through his email account if you're using tablet?
Yeah, if I had a
through
Fire.
Google, yes. Is Amazon interested in that business model? No. You know, the point for Amazon is they want everything on that device to be really fast so that you buy more books through them. Right? Their business model is different. The ISP, however, these phone carriers and stuff, they could potentially be doing this as well, and you wouldn't necessarily know. And that's one of those concerns that we have with these devices that we have no control over the operating system. You know, my iPhone, for example, Apple controls that completely. I don't really know what's going on. So when I go through Gmail to check in my email through that, it's possible that Apple is looking at it. And that's a little creepy, you know, third parties looking at it. But then again, that's not their business model. Anyway, so the story, I've been fascinated by it, and I'm really glad to hear that it's much more about the nuance of how the presentation was presented. And I think that companies...
And to whom? That seems relevant.
Yeah.
Like, is this definitely someone bragging, like, no, I really am doing a good job? Or is this, all right, new recruits, here are the tools that you have at your disposal? And I think it might be, okay, new recruits, here are the tools you have at your disposal, right? Like, wasn't it purported to be a PowerPoint presentation for spies just coming on, for new spies? Am I wrong about that?
It could be the target, yeah.
I mean, who the target of that PowerPoint presentation is matters.
Matters a lot.
In my mind.
Exactly.
Because, you know, a smart employee will try to, people just try to look good, right? So whoever's presenting that will try to look good to whoever they're receiving it, or whoever's receiving that presentation.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's so nuanced about this.
Sort of,
if I'm presenting a presentation about how well we're doing inside the company, right, like doing these certain things, I might say, hey, we've got inside tracks to all these companies, and they're working with us. And really, maybe three of those companies, they're not working with them, but we do have inside information, right? So when you phrase it that way, it's like you have inside information, like through Verizon clearly has like giving a back door to the government. In fact, we've known that for a while, that these telcos are doing that. There's boxes in these locations that are just spitting data back out.
Why that's news this week.
Right. It's not, it's only news because it's always been hush hush. Okay. And now it's, yeah, this is happening.
Okay.
That's why it's news. That's why Obama responded. Okay. Anyway, let's go on. I think we've covered that pretty well.
I just want to say something about, like, I'm capable of the kind of graphics that were on that PowerPoint presentation.
You should work for government.
I there's a future for me.
Wait, but, Bonnie, are you a spy?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not a spy.
You know what? if you're, although I do have to say, if your computer took 7 minutes to boot, maybe you wouldn't make the choice to make better graphics.
Maybe not, but, you know, that's just
nice
like a point.
Back then.
It's like a point counterpoint, like the way it really happens and the way Hollywood portrays it happens.
That's true.
The Darkland rooms with just like state-of-the-art graphics and interfaces and things, not what's actually going on.
Oh, no.
Ben's got a cool story about Wi-Fi being used in a totally different way in your home, which sounds great. I'm interested in hearing that. And we're also going to cover some geek bits, hopefully, in a second. But first, I want to let you know that you're listening to KOSP. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the room with me is Ben and Bonnie.
And coming up tomorrow at high noon on KOSP's The 7th Avenue Project. Tomorrow, it's the latest edition of the DSM, the Diagnostic Manual of Psychiatry. It's hot off the presses and once again redraws the map of mental illness. Hoarding disorder is in, for example, while Asperger's is out. Aw, it's just getting popular, though. The critics like psychotherapist Gary Greenberg say the DSM has little to do with actual disease and a lot to do with changing societal attitudes, politics, and money. Greenberg is author of The Book of Woe, The DSM, and The Unmaking of Psychiatry, and he talks to KOSP's Robert Pauly tomorrow at high noon on the 7th Avenue Project. That's going to be a good show.
I love that
show.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Isn't high noon actually the moment when the sun is straight up?
Sure.
I think.
Yeah.
So I think that in our geographic area, noon is not high noon.
Well, noon's the highest point where the sun is during that day.
Tomorrow at 12 p.m. on KUSP.
Oh,
Ben.
We got no geek bits today.
Felt like being pedantic.
I feel like I had a geek bit earlier, but, you know, visit GeekSpeak. Last night I stayed up way too late fixing the website so that we could do
so
fun things.
Is
it fun?
Yeah, and none of you can see it. Because
and in fact, it broke other things on the website, so the public has no... Anyway, stayed up till 3:30, breaking the website.
Going. Yeah,
good
awesome.
Job.
Development.
That's the way it is.
Tell me about
this
Wi-Fi thing.
Yeah, it's awesome. So this is out of the University of Washington. So computer scientists have developed, basically, it's this gesture recognition technology. It's kind of like when you stand in front of your, what's it called, Xbox Kinect? Is that the one with the gesture recognition? Yeah. And you can make all kinds of movements with your hands and everything. Well, this is technology that uses Wi-Fi instead of, I think they use infrared on the Kinect. It uses Wi-Fi, and it looks at the Doppler shift of the Wi-Fi signals bouncing off of you. And the cool thing about this is it can, well, first of all, it can actually discern Doppler shifts of like a couple hertz. Even though Wi-Fi signals are about 5 gigahertz, that's 5 billion hertz, it can discern a couple. And it's just a modified Wi-Fi, like a router. And so this thing can actually serve internet to your house, but also detect your movements, like if you're moving toward or away from it, which means that they can actually discern when you're making certain kind of movements, so you can just swipe your hand through the air to turn off the TV or something like that.
Assuming they can get that detailed.
They actually can, and they can actually do it for multiple people at once, and they can do it for people in all these different rooms.
If you have a dog and you're throwing something for the dog, the TV goes on and off.
That, you know, this is the issue. It's like you go, so, you buy a clapper in the 90s, and then you're,
and no
you're
more applause.
Rooting for your football team, and the TV turns off because you're clapping.
Don't run the TV with a clapper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lights.
Yeah, run your Christmas tree with a clapper.
Just make sure to have a clapper on the garbage disposal and the lights in the room so they toggle. Can never have both of them on the same time.
No.
That's horrible.
Don't do that.
Be clear, I don't know if we can do that being clear. Like, you're talking about Doppler shift. You're talking about basically interference patterns and detecting interference patterns. But the only thing that – so the antennas of a Wi-Fi system only have a point – they don't have triangulation. So you can't actually get direction. So you have to do everything off of Doppler effect. It's pretty amazing. The reflective qualities,
basically. Yeah, so I mean the quick explanation of Doppler – I mean, if you listen to an ambulance as it passes by, it goes like that. That's with sound. That's basically the sound waves are getting squished as the ambulance is rushing towards you, and then they're getting pulled apart when it's rushing away from you. Same thing happens with light. So if you have an object that's moving towards you, technically that object is going to appear ever so slightly blue, more bluer, more bluer.
Bluer.
Good said, as Miles would say. So more blue. And if it's moving away from you, more red. But light travels so fast that you're not going to be able to detect a Doppler shift with light. Incidentally, when I talk about finding exoplanets, that's actually one of the ways that we're looking for exoplanets, is looking at the star that the exoplanets are going around, moving towards us and away from us.
The wobbling. Because of the gravitational effect of the planet.
Exactly.
Very cool.
So, I mean, the Doppler shift, you find it all over the place, and this is just another use of it. So if you are walking towards the Wi-Fi access point, then you're going to appear, rather the Wi-Fi signals that are moving, that are bouncing off of you, are going to appear ever so slightly higher because of the Doppler shift of you moving towards the point. And if you're moving away, they're going to be lower. And like I said, even though Wi-Fi operates at 5 gigahertz, that's 5 billion hertz,
how many burritos is that?
I don't know if I can convert burritos into gigahertz. But I mean, it can detect just a couple hertz difference. Yeah. So it's really a fantastic technology.
Yeah, very cool.
I love it.
I hear ripe for comedy. That's what I hear. I can just see it on Arrested Development in a model home in Sun Valley.
You know, trying to control your TV and stuff by waving your arms.
Please.
Yeah. I have to say also, the Doppler shift is also responsible for the only good part of Star Wars Episode 1, which is the pod things that race around and around.
Nicely done, by
that sound effect is the coolest thing in the world. And everything else in that movie is bollocks.
What about metachlorides? Okay, we're going on. We're moving on.
No,
we're not talking about that. No.
Closer to topic, the sound at the beginning of the Jetsons.
Ooh, what is that?
Nice. Good.
Yeah.
I like that sound, too.
Yeah, it's a good sound.
More sound effects, everyone.
Doppler.
You're listening to Geek Speak. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Premsch. I'm Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. We are taking calls in about 15 minutes, but we're going to keep on doing some news until then. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877.
Whoa, slow that down. What?
I'll slow it down in 15 minutes.
Okay.
No?
That was just for people who already know the number, apparently.
1-800-655.
There you go.
5877.
What I have to say, my pet peeve when people leave messages is they say the content part nice and slow, and then as soon as they get to the number, they somehow speed it up.
Yes, because they know they know it already.
They know it, but I don't.
That's why I talk fast so fast, because I know so much. As Lyle's head gets larger. Hey, I've had some interesting things. So this news story about the government collecting lots of data is interesting. And I, for years, we've had chats about how our society is basically data, too data rich. Like, we collect everything. It's hard to get rid of stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, the problem now for me inherently is not my backup strategy. It's my cleansing strategy, right? I get backups of my data. I have multiple copies of my data, right? And that's kind of not good. I shouldn't have multiple backups in the sense that I have redundancy and then plus some.
Yeah. It's going to be hard on your biographer later.
Exactly. You want to level up from that.
So this kind of, I realized this week when I was using my, I have an iOS app that's not really important. I've talked about it in the previous shows, and it's a paid app, and I'm not sure it's a great app. But the app itself, I'll describe what it does. It gives me a very simple interface to my email accounts. I got like 4 email accounts, right? And I can look through my email accounts and very quickly decide if this is an email I don't ever want to see again, mm-hmm. or if this is an email that I might want to deal with. I can't actually do much in this interface because it's pretty minimal, but you can slide them up if you want to get rid of them and archive them. You slide them down. So the interface is a one-thumb interface. Mm-hmm. Just loads message by message by message. It's the app I use the most right now.
Really?
It's an app specifically designed to get rid of stuff I don't want. That's all it's for. It's throwing data away. I mean, I actually archive it, so I don't actually delete it.
It's not going away.
But it's getting out of my face, right?
Right.
The app that's most important to me right now is the thing that allows me to spend little time going through stuff so I can get rid of it. Uh-huh. Because, you know, as you know, when you get a lot of email, if the ones that are important you don't pay attention to, you've got a problem. You've got to respond to those. But a lot of stuff is like, who cares? And for example, LinkedIn over the last few days has sent me over 40 messages.
I'm trying to turn those off. I can't do it.
Aren't you frustrated with that?
I am.
I have successfully turned them off.
Braggart.
Man, Ben's
we'll be talking to you later.
I also mistakenly spent some time on LinkedIn, connecting some people. Ugh. More people.
Why'd you do that?
What's happened is it used to be that when people asked me, hey, connect with me, I'd be like, I don't know who you are. I've never met you in the physical world. No. But now I'm like, well, my role and my job is to be a public figure and to meet people and interact with them and connect with them. So they asked me to join me on Facebook because they saw me talk somewhere. Okay. I say yes. And so now all of a sudden, the people that are in my social networks are people that are interested in what I have to say, not necessarily friends of mine. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to close them down, right? So I'm saying yes a lot now. So if you find me in Google Plus or Twitter or whatever, you say, well, Twitter, you don't have to do anything. People just follow you, which is nice.
Yeah.
Anyway, so data, getting rid of data is the most important thing in my life right now. It's so sad.
I'm sorry about your hard, hard life. That seems to be a running theme in the show, is just how woebegotten
y'all are. Difficult. Wait, it took a minute to boot up the machine. I had 3 seconds before I can type. Oh, my gosh. The humanity. First world problems. Ben?
I'm hungry now.
Yeah?
For a burrito.
You got a story here called Atomic Bombs Help Solve Brain Mystery.
I'm trying to get my brain around this. How does an atomic bomb help us know something about the brain producing neurons? I don't get it.
Radiocarbon dating. So, it was that. So first of all, the question is, does the brain create new neurons, right?
Throughout its life?
Because for a while we've thought, well, maybe it doesn't create, maybe it does create new neurons. We're not really certain of that. And it's a really difficult thing to...
Yeah, I thought it was super easy up to a point, and then you just start calcifying and losing them. So you have to do extra things to not lose them.
Right. So first, just a quick rundown of radiocarbon dating. So
can we answer the neuron thing? Oh, this thing answers the neuron thing. Yeah. Okay.
In good time, young Lyle.
The story has started. Go ahead.
It's a journey.
Join us now. A journey
on GeekSpeak. So radiocarbon dating. So the way it works is, well, back during the Cold War era, we exploded a whole bunch of radioactive bombs.
Testing.
All over the place, yeah. Mostly Nevada. Poor Nevada. Oh, man.
It's taking hits after hits.
I really need to stop anthropomorphizing states because Nevada really just has it bad. So in doing that, we released a whole bunch of carbon-14, that's an isotope of carbon, into the atmosphere. And that isotope got used. Yeah, got used by life forms, right? So basically the way that you can utilize this to figure out things, that you can actually figure out the age of elements or of items, not elements, but you can figure out the age of bones. You can figure out the age of, actually, I think 3 years ago, I think I covered a story about whiskey and how they were determining when, I think it was whiskey, when whiskey is as old as they say it is, mm-hmm, versus when it's actually new and it's fake. And you can look at it and see whether or not it has the radioactive isotope, the isotope of carbon-14 in it. If it doesn't have the isotope of carbon-14, that means that the plants that grew, that were used to create the whiskey, were alive before all of the atomic bombs went off, right? So that's the idea there. That's the basics of radiocarbon dating.
And to be clear, the reason it works is that organic matter takes stuff out of the environment and uses it. So if you find a piece of wood, the environment that it grew in had a different type of footprint than other times of life. And you can look at our history of our planet of how much of carbon-14 was in the atmosphere and therefore how much wood would consume it and use it. And you see a steady decline, and that decline point or increase point,
traditionally, yes.
Traditionally, you can determine, if this wood, this kind of tree, has this type of carbon in it, this amount of this from this environment, it grew up at this point in time. That's how we use it. It's only organic matter. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that because we made a lot more carbon-14, we get some spikes.
Like orders of magnitude more carbon-14. Yeah. All of a sudden, bam, we've got things that died before a certain date have virtually no carbon-14 in them anywhere. But things that died after that date started using this carbon-14 in their body because they're organic matter.
I see. Okay. So it's a useful spike.
It's a, well, it's a useful spike. I mean, I don't, I really hesitate to say that atomic bombs are good,
yeah,
but
yeah, that's, realize that statement should come with a lot of qualifications.
Yeah. but so I can't go into the detail of this mechanism. I'm going to put the link up on the GeekSpeak webpage. But basically, we've been able to use a type of radiocarbon dating to figure out if we have in brains of people who died at about a certain time, who were born before, we could actually figure out if the neurons had come into being before all of the explosions and stuff, or after. And so if this person was born maybe just before and their brain developed just before all of the nuclear testing and everything, uh-huh. if their brain had neurons that had carbon-14 in them, we could infer that some new neurons were created later in their life.
Okay,
and
I got it.
From there, we can determine whether or not brains...
So?
Grow neurons. And yes, in fact, they're actually it's all in the hippocampus. The quote is that more than a third of hippocampal neurons were regularly replaced, with roughly 1400 neurons added, new neurons added each day during adulthood.
Awesome.
It's not a huge amount in the scope of the brain and how mm-hmm. many neurons we have in our brain, and it's mainly in this small area of the brain that
it's
we create
in memory.
New neurons.
But you know what that tells me is that we're remaking our memories all the time.
We certainly are.
Even well, more not reliable.
I feel like we've had this conversation before.
So anyway.
I want to say I remember it, but I probably don't.
Pretty interesting. It's kind of like the Doppler effect. You find it all over the place. Same with radiocarbon dating. You can use it to determine all kinds of things, including the age of your whiskey. Or I don't remember what alcohol it was. I don't know my alcohol. I don't know what comes from wheat and what comes from grain and barley.
That and more things Ben doesn't know on GeekSpeak.
We are... I don't know anything.
We are going to start taking your calls now with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us questions about stuff we don't know, and we'll answer. No, we actually do have a lot of knowledge here on the show, and you're welcome to give us a call and ask away. The phone number is
1-800-655-5877.
So, Ben... You got some car news?
I have some pretty scary car news, and unfortunately, I don't have a solution. But
I know the story.
Oh, I saw this.
Yeah.
There's a,
so yeah, police are stumped actually, and security researchers are stumped about this too. Basically, the idea is you go to unlock your car, you press the button, it unlocks your car, you get in, and that is supposed to be a secure exchange, right? And in fact, the little fob that you press the button on and the car itself, the code that is transmitted is always changing all the time, and so it's supposed to not really be particularly crackable. But surveillance video these days has started to show, mainly in Long Beach, but also other places in the states too, Illinois, that people are walking up to cars that they don't own, pressing a button on some mysterious device that they're holding, and unlocking the cars and getting in and stealing cash and whatever's in the car.
And it's only the passenger side of the car.
Yeah, apparently the thief always hits the passenger side of the car, and we're not really sure why. That's pretty much all there is to it. I mean, actually, I don't have a...
I've heard a little bit of how it might be happening.
Really? It sounds like an electronic master key of some kind.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it actually might be some kind of override thing where they're overpowering. It seems like they get really close, and they seem to push something, and then the lock
just
unlocks.
Stun them.
It's possible that it's actually a physical manifestation of some kind of circuitry where they're overloading the circuitry that actually sends the command over that opens it. The thing that's interesting, though, is that the alarms don't go off in the car, which means the CPU is involved to some degree.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. But they are – and the assumption of why they're going on that side of the car, two reasons. It could be that they're damaging that hardware completely. It's possible that there's damage happening or potentially could be damaging.
Yeah.
And it's also possible that there's actually just more going on electrically on the other side of the car. So there's more dash, there's more stuff. Right?
Mm.
So it could be just a side effect of how it's working. But we don't know a lot about it, which is really great. I know. I love it. I love it.
Which is really great.
I love the mystery because normally it's rare to have that kind of mystery going on. So it's nice to see a little bit of, huh? How does this work?
Yeah.
You know, we got calls.
It's too bad about people's stuff, though. That's too bad.
Well, yeah, okay. Sorry. That's right. I get all excited about technology. Like, yeah, and then people get their stuff stolen. And that was so neat. No, Lyle. It wasn't. Yeah. It was bad. Oh, right. How they did it, though, was cool.
Well, might be. I don't know.
Right, it might just be fake. We don't even know.
You know, the thing I realize with the rush of the show, I don't actually have some kind of tie-in to Rick. So I have no idea how he's telling me who's on the phone. So being on the phone is great. You're on hold. I'll know about you soon. I'll be able to introduce you. But first, Ben, you got another really short one, I think, about Facebook.
I do have another one about Facebook, which is that Facebook is Facebook has removed the link to download your posts. So remember back in the day with Google Plus's main advertising thing when they were trying to get off the ground was, hey, your data is yours. So if you want to download your data out of the system, that's totally fine. We got your back. And then Facebook, of course, had to respond and say, oh, actually, we've just implemented that too, you know?
Me too.
Hey,
yeah, that's too, you guys.
Yeah. And yeah. So now they've actually removed one link, one ability, the ability to download wall posts, which, of course, is all of your posts. Now, you can download messages, you can download all these other things, photos and albums, but you can't download your wall posts. And that just strikes me as I don't know, what's the word? Evil, maybe.
Well, I don't know. You could take it the other way. Like, okay, now no one can down your wall posts. I feel more secure.
Well, no, but I mean, in order to download your wall posts, you need access to your account.
Right, and people can get that.
Well, that's true, but that's like saying we should just delete your account so no one can get to it.
It's more inconvenient for you than a safety.
Well, the idea that what they seem to be saying by their action is no, actually, your data is not yours.
Oh.
Your data is ours,
yeah,
and sorry, you can't have it. So that makes me feel really uncomfortable. And
Facebook, I feel you should know that I'm uncomfortable. I mean, what do you do? What do you do about that?
What do I?
You decide to use the service or not, I think is the way that it goes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm hoping at some point that Facebook is no longer the de facto social network. I mean, they used to change a lot, and they change less now. And I mean, I'm kind of like, let's get a new one, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It takes time, of course. I'm using Google Plus a lot, but then again, Google has got everything. You know, they've everything as well.
Yeah.
LinkedIn is spamming me too much. I mean, it's, you know, I'm sensitive about this kind of thing.
But
I use app.net. You guys know about alpha.app.net?
No.
App.net's it's like a Twitter thing, but you actually pay for it. Therefore, there's a lot less people on it. There's a lot less spam.
Oh.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Should we take some calls?
Okay.
Let's do it.
What do we got?
Well, we got Conrad from Germany. So I think that's always a fun thing to do, right?
Yeah.
Oh, and I took the wrong line. I don't want to hang up on that person. So, Conrad, stay with us. Nancy from Santa Cruz, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think you guys are great. And Bonnie, she is so funny. Thanks.
I agree.
Oh, hey. Nancy's my new favorite person.
It's a fun program this morning. I want to go back to your conversation earlier about having multiple devices with and trying to get rid of your data. So specifically,
yes.
I have an iMac, I have a MacBook Air, and I have an iPhone.
And you get to read your email three times.
Right.
I get it, exactly. And when I go into the preference settings for accounts on all the devices, I can't find a setting that says delete message when you have deleted it.
Yes.
In other words, it'll delete it when you...
So, unfortunately, the way to solve this problem is a little complicated. But
I like complications.
Okay. So currently you're most likely using a mail protocol called POP3. That's something. And you should be using, and when I say should be, this problem will go away if you do. That's why I say should. Using IMAP. And IMAP is equivalent to POP3, but it does something that's very important. It actually keeps track of the state of everything on the server, which means that if I read a message one account, I'm on one device, and then I go to another device and look at the same account, they sync up automatically. In reality, you do download the email to your computer, but it also stays up on the server. And that's why the should has a little asterisk next to it. If you use this, your ISP, your internet service provider, that actually hosts your email, keeps your mail.
It's Comcast.
It keeps your mail the entire time. If you're using a Comcast email address, it keeps your mail the entire time. So if you're going to be changing your mail around anyway, I highly suggest you decouple your email service provider from your telco, the way you get your internet. Mm-hmm. So right now, if you've got a Comcast email address, what I suggest you do is go get an email address that is not associated with how you connect to the internet. And that's important because if you want to, at a later date, change the way you connect to the internet, if your email address is locked to that service, you can't get rid of that service. So get your email to be something like Gmail or Yahoo or a paid system of some sort. And when the reason I suggest this is that you're going to have to reset up all your devices anyway. So you might as well just make a new account and move that direction and use IMAP.
I just did that in January. I had a Yahoo email address, and I just moved it to Comcast.
Oh, that was the wrong way.
I didn't talk to you in time, huh? I have both addresses at this point. So you're suggesting I set up a third address, which I'm.
Why'd you move away? Wait, why'd you move
away? Because I'm building a website, and I want my
own domain
to relate to the website.
Absolutely, that's the way to do it. Your own domain. Like my personal email address is lyle@troxel.com, right?
Everybody.
If you're talking about GeekSpeak, though, use my lyle@geekspeak.org, right? But the point is that name, actually right now, it actually points over to Google. But if I don't like Google at some point, I can just move it, and I never have to change my email address because I own that domain. It's a really important idea. So I highly suggest you do that. But when you do set up this new mail with this new domain for your website and all that, make sure you use IMAP, and then you won't have the syncing problem with email. Okay?
Excellent.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for the call. Take care.
Thank you.
And Conrad from Germany, sorry to tease you. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Conrad, calling from Germany.
Welcome.
Guten Tag.
Are you getting me?
Yes, no problem.
Oh, wonderful. Well, this is the first time I tried to contact you, because generally I listen to your stuff on podcasts, but now I'm sort of laid low nursing a flu, so I can listen to you geeks live, and it's always as entertaining as ever. But I had some sort of bet on that you would probably mention this week's Cell paper on the regenerating hippocampal neurons. And this is for my day job as a pathologist. I'm very much interested in all that sort of thing. And I just wanted to tell you that the most important bit of all that, in terms of relevance to anything that we can sort of understand about regenerating hippocampal neurons, is that you always have to look at the connectivity of those. So although it sounds exciting that there may be some regrowing, it's absolutely no idea if they're actually connecting correctly.
That's what all those memory exercises and so on are about, is connecting everything.
Yeah, well, anyway, the problem in terms of computer speak would be you've got all sorts of wonderful clients, but your patch cables are not necessarily connected. So you got those running, but sort of the interaction in the brain is not guaranteed. So although it's quite an exciting and interesting paper, I mean, the functionality of it is completely unknown, and thereby the relevance for it.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it kind of inferred?
I wanted to chip in on your discussion.
Isn't it kind of inferred that we do make new connections? I mean, we learn new things, right? We learn new things all the time. Isn't that mean that connections are being formed?
No, not necessarily, because of course there are new connections, but we don't know the correct ones. And only by telling that you sort of learn things that may be mediated by new connections, but I mean, the simple fact that you have regenerating neurons doesn't necessarily mean that they're useful neurons.
Mm.
But on the basis assumption that we keep on learning, that's okay.
Yeah.
But even with the remnant hippocampal neurons, you could keep on learning because they may be forming right connections. New ones, regenerating ones, may not be sort of properly connected.
Right.
This is all very interesting in neuroscience at the moment, because there's obviously this huge push towards understanding what's called the connectome. So the totality of all the connections in the human brain, which is obviously easier in mice to regenerate, but also I mean, you want to know it in man, but this is a tough one.
I would say for different definitions of easy, it's not easy to map the entire brain of the mouse, but it's possible. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Now, so do you find that right now we're in this? It feels to me like we're in this amazing space where we're going to know more about the brain every 5 years. We're going to know leaps and beyond about what we've known before, and that's exciting. I mean, I find it fascinating.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great time to be a neuroscientist but still, I mean, coming from computer sciences, I'm trying to draw analogies between the two fields. It's clear that if you don't know all the connections, your inference on the functionality of the brain will be extremely limited at best.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a topology of your network, what are you you're not going to be able to tell anything sensible about the network you're running.
Yeah. Conrad, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for listening to GeekSpeak.
Wait, hold on.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a question.
Oh,
right? Conrad, I've got a listening question for you. So you said that you listen mostly by podcast, and today is a rare event where you're listening live. Does it affect the quality of your listening experience to be listening over the podcast versus live?
No. I mean, I must tell you, because internet connections on this side of the Atlantic are very good.
Yeah, you braggart. Yeah, we know. So we're here.
I have problems about your whatever DSL, slow DSL or no DSL. I always have to chuckle, of course.
Well, you are listening. Wait, Conrad, you are listening through us through DSL right now, because we have a DSL out to our ISP.
Oh, okay.
Necessarily.
Well, if you're talking about your sort of home connections, right. I gather that your KUSP has rather a good backbone or not.
Yeah. You know, it's quite good. We actually have it rebroadcast at our local ISP with a high connection. Hey, thank you, Conrad, for the call.
Yeah.
Take
bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye.
Dankeschön. Guten Abend.
Braggart.
I never get to use German. I never get to speak German.
You can
speak
German. But is it Abend over there right now?
It is.
It's
evening.
Okay, so you were more correct because I said Guten Tag, but apparently
it's evening.
Incorrect.
No,
yeah.
No.
We
it's like
make
8.
Points
I think
content.
Actually Wednesday
8.
I'm going to be in France, so kind of same time zone.
Oh, quel bon for you.
Hey, but right now let's go to Vienna. Actually, Vienna, Virginia. Mark, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there. How you doing?
Quite well. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Hey, I got a question about POP servers. I've heard on both GeekSpeak and on other tech programs I've listened to that the distinction between POP and IMAP is that POP does not enable you to keep your email on the server after you've downloaded it.
It's not designed to be that way.
Okay, well, I guess my question is, my ISP only offers POP. I don't have an option to do IMAP.
Yep.
Okay. However, in our house, we're using both Microsoft Outlook and the Apple Mail client. And
right.
On both of those, when I set it up, I can select a number of days that I want email to remain on the server after I've downloaded it.
Right.
Normally, I have it set up to maintain the mail on the server for 30 days. That gives me an option if I'm at some other computer, I can use the webmail client to access something. But, you know, everybody tells me you can only, download it and then it's gone.
So the POP3 protocol was designed to such that you would download it and not use it anymore. But there were other ways of communicating with the server and configuring the server to now kind of cheat an IMAP type effect, meaning that the mail stays on the server. When your POP attachment connects up, it looks for messages that it has seen or hasn't seen before and downloads the ones that it doesn't have a copy of yet. There's not a lot of... So the mail client is doing some more smart things. It's not really part of the protocol. It's more like the clients do this themselves. The issue that people have when they do that, and that's the kind of the design for a while because people are frustrated, the issue is as you have multiple clients that attach, your iPhone and your desktop and your Mac environment, they don't actually sync the same way. If you delete a message, let's say you read your mail, you get it from your iPhone, you delete the mail. You've deleted the local copy, and your mail client on your phone is going to remember not to download it again. But the message is still up on the server, and the other client that hasn't communicated with the iPhone, when it goes to look for the emails, it hasn't seen that one, so it downloads it again. So you get this kind of syncing, but not really fluidly. That's what the IMAP thing removes from. Now, IMAP is a heavier protocol, which means it takes more service, more features for the server to maintain it. You contact the server a lot more. You kind of make a connection. But power of the computers is not really the weak point now. It's really our time and energy. So if you find that your current format works, great. When you run into a situation where it stops working because the mail clients aren't smart enough to do what you want it to do, that's when I'd suggest IMAP makes a lot of sense. The other aspect of this is that if you only check your email on one computer and it's, you know, after the 30-day window or whatever time, the messages are no longer on the server. They are gone. They're only on your local computer. And then you have a hard drive fail. You'll lose your mail. So that's one of the other reasons to think about that kind of version. It's like the first cloud storage.
Well, that's what Time Machine is good for.
Yes. The good backup strategy. I highly agree. Mark, thank you for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care.
You know, since we were talking to Conrad the pathologist, maybe we could talk about this power of thought story about the toy helicopter?
Okay, you got 20 seconds.
All right, cool. Well, there's a toy helicopter that's guided by the power of your thought. They put this cap with electrodes on your head. And then you imagine clenching your left or your right fist to move it left.
Just imagine
or
it.
Right. You just imagine. You yeah. focus on, like, what would it be like if I clenched my left or right fist? But you don't want to get angry when you're doing this and clench your fists. And then the helicopter, I don't know.
Attacks people.
Yeah. It goes crazy.
I've played with that brain sensing stuff by, like, thinking. And you got to be in a meditative state. You got to get your brain to, like, a neutral level.
They showed that meditators actually do it better.
Yeah. No, I'd agree.
Mind-body awareness.
That was definitely the experience I had of, well, think up. Wait, what does thinking up mean? And I start getting in my head. And, okay, wait, just meditate. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. And the airman with me was Bonnie Jean Primch and Ben Jaffe. Answering phones, Rick. And, Rick, thank you for being here every week. It's great to have you. We'll be back next week.